Well, it's a dynamic duo, we'll be back again. Other backers, DJ, you better pack it in. You're lacking sense, trying to tangle with us. Go with the big black bullies in the back of the bus to smack you up. And stealing your lunch money, you're such a buddy. If you look just a touch, only by the end of the day, that's understandable. What can I say? You got strong man to be.
Gary has absolutely no idea what has happened to it. Still doesn't know.
How do they still let us on the internet?
They don't.
We just email it to select a few people.
How do they keep letting us on Apple and Spotify? Clearly there is nobody doing quality control at either of those two premises.
Well, we got an invitation from Amazon Podcast this week.
We could be the thing that brings down Bezos' empire. That would be our great gesture for humanity. You're fucking welcome, world.
Oh, dear. Oh, funny.
Bulls episode 259. Vale Dean Jones.
Yeah. Actually, I wish I'd saved the post, but someone said today that it's hard to explain now how big one-day cricket was in the 80s and 90s.
Yep.
Like, you know, we sort of bitch about, you know, endless, useless series, but like, I can remember Christmas holidays where you would sort of legit circle certain games on the calendar, you know. Oh, well, we've got to be, you know, got to have dinner all done so we can sit in front of the cricket and watch this game.
Well, it was all there was in terms of televised cricket.
Yeah,
the only cricket
so.
There was the World Series Cup, the state comp, and Test cricket. That's all there was. And these people were larger than life. And you also, I mean, Adam and I were talking about this last week in terms of the 80s World Series Cup highlights that Fox and Sky have been running. And he was remarking on how slow it all is. You know, even Dean Jones was slow by modern standards. But even the thing that struck me about watching those things, because Sky replayed them all earlier in the year, is that kind of middle to late 80s period, Dean Jones was playing a different game. Like, he was batting so much faster. He was this fucking electrified pole vaulter, all fucking arms and elbows and gangly, and batting with this huge splayed stance and constantly running people out and getting run out. And he was just this bag of demented energy that captivated you. There was, you know, AB could be your hero because he was this tough, gruff Australian captain, you know, being an Australian in the most Australian way possible. Or you could like Steve Waugh or whatever else, but Dean Jones was generally everybody's favourite cricketer for the kids of our generation. You know, the 40 somethings who grew up through the 80s. Dean Jones was the single most interesting and captivating cricketer. He kind of took over from Viv Richards when Viv's because, you know, for a generation there while Australia was shit in the first half of the 80s, Viv Richards was probably most of Australia's favourite cricketer because the Windies were out here every second summer, out in Australia every second summer. But Dino was this just wild force of nature. I mean, I remember trying to bat like him with my legs, you know, a metre apart and not understanding. I mean, even watch Dino batting, he kind of hinges like a trebuchet about to fling a fucking, you know, some sort of projectile in a medieval village. He's just these big levers just kind of flaring up and then just bursts of furious energy. You and I are not even Victorian, so we don't have an excuse for being dementedly fucking obsessed with him.
Yeah, that's the Victorian thing's almost like a cult. But like in basketball, you always talk about, you know, guys that are out of era, you know, particularly big guys now. Oh, you know, he would have been a great player in the 80s when the rules were like this and you could play this particular way, or the other way, you know, guards that were, you know, hit 4 3-pointers in a game in the 70s and now they would probably take 15 a game. Well, Dean Jones is, you know, he missed the T20 revolution.
What, as we said last week, as you know, because you've definitely listened back to the pod, Dean Jones with modern bats and modern boundaries would be the biggest star in cricket by a long way, because what he was doing with those fucking balsa wood sticks that they had in the day, and MCG boundaries that ran right to the gutters. Which is interesting because, I mean, I think Dino's period where he was the most captivating cricketer in the world was probably his county bat period. You know, he was famous in someone wrote one of the Australian cricket writers. Every Australian cricket writer's had a Dino piece today, which is obviously fair enough. Chris Barrett from the SMH's piece was about the when Dino went to Kookaburra, when Kookaburra were just moving into the bat game, it pretty much launched Kookaburra bats. There was a period where Kookaburra made was balls. They didn't make and hockey equipment. They didn't make cricket bats. And they got into the bat game, and one of their highest profile guys they got was Dean Jones across from County. And you can argue that Kookaburra's position in the game has got a lot to do with Dean Jones using their stuff. But my memories of Dean Jones's peak was probably earlier than that, back when he was using a county bat, and he was sort of batting, you know, three or four or five, depending on who was captaining, in a one-day game, and making a 40 off 30 in ridiculous fashion in a usually losing Australian side.
Not even the playing part of T20, and he did coach a fair bit overseas, but he's a guy that's like he didn't follow the traditional ex larrikin Australian player into either, you know, the Aussie coaching setup or the Channel 9 commentary box.
Well, there is a reason for that, and I think we probably need to address this too, is that, you know, Dean Jones was capable of saying some fucking racist, stupid shit. And the reason his commentary career fell over was the time that he called Hashim Angla a terrorist on a live mic, which wasn't a good moment. And he's, you know, he's like all flawed characters. He's been known to say some ham-fisted shit. But I can only hope that all of us get to be remembered for our moments of genius and not for our, you know, occasionally fucking dreadful takes and the dumb things we say when we think nobody else is around.
I guess there's still characters in the game. It's funny because he's completely a different sort of character, but the guy he reminds me of a little bit is Bailey. You know, that willingness to experiment with his game and try different shit, and that sort of in and out of the one day side. Bailey was, you know, completely the opposite him in terms of character. So
he wasn't. I mean, he was more like warning character in terms of Jones. That absolutely immovable belief that he was going to prevail. Obviously backed up by generations of Victorian barracking claiming that he was hard done by when he wasn't being picked.
Yeah. Anyway, it's a bit sad. He was 59. That old, really.
Yeah, he was 59.
Yeah. And you would have thought, like, you know, he's around doing physical stuff. You know, you can't be a coach. You know, he wasn't like a front office guy sitting in front of a computer. He's out running fielding drills and stuff like that. He wouldn't have been massively overweight or unfit, I would imagine.
No. But, I mean, I don't know what he's after hours.
Yeah, that's true.
You know, that generation of Australian cricketers tended to treat themselves, you know, they treated themselves reasonably well when they were playing, but, you know, after hours, they tended to absolutely pound it in terms of the booze and everything else. So, it's a somber day for Australian-born kids of our generation. And, you know, to be fair, probably cricket lovers of our generation worldwide.
Yeah, he was the sort of guy that you would think that he had this amazing sort of long Australian career, not the sort of guy that was in and out of the team
basically 1984 to 92, if that, you know, and the latterly was kind of, he was basically done by the, I feel like that his last sustained period in the Australian team was the Ashes win in 89. So it was really just, it was like one of those, you know, brief starburst kind of careers, which was like a lot of his innings were like these brief starburst kind of innings.
Yep. Yeah.
Anyway, in happier news, happy wooden spoon day to the Brisbane Broncos. You pack of cunts. couldn't think of a more deserving leaseholder of the spoon for this year to come.
Very Nixian. I guess the only difference is the Knicks never had a sustained run of success like Brisbane did.
Yeah, two titles in the 70s isn't really.
No. But the you know, I don't know whether entitlement's the right word, but that just sort of thinking that you're better than you actually, like the actual sort of recent results have.
Yeah. Bongo's exceptionalism and Nick's exceptionalism look very similar to each other.
So someone posted the Knicks social media account, like they can't even get their social media right, posted a photo today.
Well, that's probably because of the quality of person that they can hire to go and work with Jim Dolan.
Posted a photo today of Thibodeau in front of a blank whiteboard, and it's like,
oh no, no, hang on, no, stick with me.
Yeah,
a false flag operation. They did that on purpose because the attention.
You reckon they did it just to get the clicks up?
Did it for the clicks because it's engagement overall with social media, even if it's bad social media. You're still getting your name out there.
Oh, dear. It wasn't quite up there. What was it, Orlando, that tweeted out the photo with the whiteboard behind them with all their
the
draft?
It was either Orlando or it was a Vlade Divac Kings front office.
It definitely sounds like a Kings thing.
But the kid Mero was on Dan Libertad's radio show today, and he was talking about the fact that they saw on the Madison Square Garden marquee in New York, they have the coming events that are coming to the MSG, and most of it's sort of stuff that's happening in 2021, and one of the things they were promoting was the Knicks season, and the tagline is the Knicks, there is nowhere else, and it's like literally appealing to Knicks fans who know that the team is garbage and, you know, they should be giving it away, but they've got nothing else to do. They're nothing else in their life. It doesn't matter what they do. They're kind of appealing to that Stockholm syndrome element of Knicks fans who just don't have any choice but to keep turning up because they've got nowhere else to go.
Yeah. Anyway, back to basketball teams that are actually relevant right at the moment. I'm still coming around to the fact that I have to be a Heat fan this postseason, but it feels good.
Of course,
and I think
how did it not feel good?
I'm actually really impressed with the way the Heat and Jimmy Butler have sort of played the media narrative a bit, because the Jimmy buckets, clutch Jimmy, you know, it's this big narrative every time they play, and yet he's not really hogging the ball. Dragic is taking more shots than him. And they bounce around going, well, whoever's hot, we'll just run the shit through them. Like, they're so flexible and so that they have this ability not to have to stick to one particular game plan no matter what. But also, they seem to have the egos to be able to go, well, you know, this rookie is going to score 36 points a game and we're just going to ride him until it burns out.
I don't know. 37 points in 36 minutes off the bench.
And
they were putting the ball in his hand all through that game. He was the fucking lead distributor. One turnover. Yeah. Fucking hell. That's a game. This is Tyler Hero, folks.
Yeah.
And as a lot of media have pointed out, this is the whitest looking dude there's no better troll of Boston than beating them with a team full of white dudes. Dragic and Duncan Robinson and all that sort of stuff. Your fucking MAGA chodes like Gordon Hayward are going to be very upset about that sort of stuff.
I was thinking, right, are you better off drafting?
Me personally. Like,
I know theoretically you want to draft as high as possible, right? But are you better off drafting top three and then not having a draft pick until 12? Because I was thinking about this, right? If your draft pick, depending on the draft, I guess, but if your draft pick like 4 to 10, you sort of think that you're one of the top NBA players, you know, in the league. You just think that you are because you're a top 10 draft pick. But if you're outside that top 10 or top 12, you're like, well, I'm good enough to be in the NBA. And you are good enough to be NBA because you've gone in the lottery. But it's, you've got that chip of, well, I didn't fucking go top 10. Well, fuck you guys. I'm gonna work harder. And it just seems like those mid-teens draft picks overachieve their expectation. Like, you don't really hear about a number 8 pick popping that much. You know, obviously the top 3 guys are just the quality guys, so that, you know, they tend to hit more often than not. But I just wonder whether those mid-range guys just drift through thinking they're a top draft pick but not willing to put the work in to really, you know, prove anyone wrong or sort of overachieve what they've been picked as.
There's a big confirmation bias there because you remember the lower picks who did well. But but no, I could certainly...
Yeah, I guess there's for every hero or Jokic, there's, you know, 20 that just fucking fade out of the league after 2 years.
You just don't remember. Yeah. I mean, what do you got here? If you look at last year, 4 was DeAndre Hunter, Darius Garland, Jarrett Culver, Kobe White, yeah, who's been useful for the Bulls.
Yeah, it's been pretty
Jackson
good.
Jackson Hayes. Rui Hachimura was useful for the Wizards. Cam Reddish, but Cameron Johnson, PJ Washington, and then Tyler Hero at 13. So it's kind of...
And then where did Brandon Clark... Because didn't he go like late teens as well?
21.
He was really good for Memphis, 21. Mm. Mm.
Darius Bazley was handy. He was at 23. Nassir Little was okay for the Blazers. And Matisse Thybulle was at 20. But again, you kind of remember the confirmation bias, the ones that it was successful.
Okay, so then my next theory is, if you've got the 3rd or 4th pick, are you better off trading down for 2
move.
Picks?
Yes,
yeah,
you
like,
are.
Get 2 chops
at
it.
If you got the number 3 pick, you should not trade down to the 5 unless you get Luka Doncic out of the deal, because I'm currently looking at the 2018 draft, which was when the Doncic-Trae Young swap. I mean, Trae Young's a perfectly, you know, a very good basketball player, but he's not Luka Doncic.
Yep.
And again, you've got those that kind of 6 to 10 space, is like Mo Bamba, Wendell Carter Jr., Colin Sexton, Kevin Knox, Mikal Bridges, who's okay. And then you get to Shai Gilgeous-Alexander, who was actually drafted by the Hornets, traded to the Clippers, and now is excellent on the – and he was part of the swag that went to OKC.
Yeah.
And Michael Porter Jr. at 14.
Yep.
Cause he kept falling because of his injuries.
I know it looks like, though, the jokes about Denver losing today just so they could get to 3-1 and you know, win the series is pretty good. But – they sort of play it. They feel like they're playing with house money, and the fact that they're at this stage of their development with a guy that's 22 or 23 and Jokic is 25 and Porter's a rookie and, like, all their guys are super young, like, they can take those big swings on a Bol Bol or whoever is the next one in the draft that has high upside but has an injury history or – you know, it is seen as a bit of a project. And like you said, if they hit on one every 3 years, it's probably enough.
But, I mean, there's another factor here that probably needs to be factored in, is that, you know, in the 17 draft, you had Donovan Mitchell at 13 and then Bam Adebayo at 14.
That's what I said, around that 12 range.
But in the 16 draft, you got, like, Domantas Sabonis at 11. You that kind of sort of 11, 12, 13, 14 range. But keep in mind that you get a better quality team there. You're now not in the team.
Yes.
You're in the teams that are right at the back of the lottery, the teams that only just missed out on playoffs. You're in the
that and that's of- we've talked about that before, haven't we? Like, if you gave the Spurs the number 5 draft pick every year, what would they do with it? If you gave the Heat the number 5 draft pick every year, they'd probably be, you know, unearthing a hero every single year because, A, they'd make a smarter pick, and B, their development is just fucking spot on.
Yeah.
You know? And this is where I think having a really clear coaching and front office philosophy helps you, like, not just pick, but, like, those undrafted guys, those guys at the back of the draft, is like, you say to them, if we draft you and you come here, this is what you're going to have to do. Like, there's no... Well, you know, I'll bring my crew and I'll do what I like. You basically turn up, roll your sleeves up and get to work. You know what you're in for. You're joining an established culture. You're not trying to make the culture.
Yeah. In short, I think we've concluded that it's better to be a good team.
Yeah, that's right.
And it's better to be a good team and draft in the teens and lower.
Yeah.
Well, even in the lower. Say, Caris LeVert, Malik Beasley were 19, 20 in this draft I'm looking at here. Pascal Siakam was 27. You know, that sort of shit. Malcolm Brogdon was 36. It's the same kind of shit over and over again. It turns out that good teams are better at identifying talent than bad teams.
Mm.
And the Philadelphia 76ers are a loser franchise. And that infects everything they do.
So if they hire D'Antoni, are they going to have to trade Embiid and Harris?
No. Because they would whoever they hire is hired on the understanding that they're going to make the best out of whatever team they've got. Because they've got a huge investment in that team.
Mm.
So all they're going to change, I'll guarantee you this, all they're going to change is, I mean, you're not going to be able to trade Tobias Harris because they paid him a shitload of money, and that's an awful contract. They're going to have to wait until that contract gets near the end and it becomes expiring. But no one's going to take that. I know a lot of bad contracts have been traded, but it's going to have to be traded for other bad contracts. But Joel Embiid's going nowhere, and Ben Simmons is going nowhere. Because they're wedded to the idea of making that core work because they've just invested so much of their lives in it. The owners and the members of the front office who have been around there so long that they cannot give up on the idea that otherwise their life's work is a failure. And nobody wants to admit that, particularly if you're a billionaire and you've gotten this far in your life by doing that sort of shit.
Yeah, it doesn't. This seems like his decision to go to the Lakers to me, where it's like, well
he's not there yet. That's
true. He might go to Indiana and actually be, you know, that might be a much better fit.
Well, it's interesting because, I mean, the sort of question arises, so why did Billy Donovan jump at the chance of joining the Bulls, given that he was on a team that, you know, that was facing a rebuild, and all he's doing is trading that for a team that's maybe a year or two further into the rebuild, but you could argue has already made their picks and probably not picked as well as they could with the Chicago Bulls. But it's 4 years guaranteed instead of the 1 or 2 years he was going to get with the OKC. And there's about to be a huge rush of jobs. And you know, he probably wants to make sure he's got a gig at the end of this, given that there's going to be more high profile contenders than there will be jobs.
Yeah. It'll be fascinating to see what Atkinson seems like a fit for OKC, but if I was him, I'd be going, well, if you want me to develop this side, you know, you've got to put a bit of faith in me to let me, you know, coach the side when they become good enough to play finals. I wonder whether he's leery of taking a job like the OKC job because then it sort of, you know, confirms the stereotype that he's a development coach. It's a pretty good job to get, though.
I would take that job over, you know, a lot of other ones just because they've got a cleverer front office. They might have, you know, dubious owners and be in a city that's not big enough to support an NBA team, but Presti's front office is sharp. They know what they're doing. But, you know, front offices would be right to think that all the evidence so far indicates that Kenny Atkinson is a Brett Brown. He can coach a development team, but he can't coach a star team.
Yeah.
Or an ego-driven team. So there's no – of course any team that looked to hire him would look to hire him as a developmental coach first and kind of expect to be looking for the exit when the team started to become more ego-driven.
Yeah, I would love that OKC job because I think the development, a little bit like what Denver's trying to do, you know, like the development never ends. And I really admire what Denver did where they looked at Murray and just thought that he was, while he had flaws, he was such a good fit with Jokic that maxing him was like a good bet. You know, it wasn't... no one knew, like even the Denver guys, I've been reading and listening to quite a few of the Denver guys this week because I find that you have to listen to the Denver guys to get anything about Denver because everything, all the national perspective is all through the Clippers or the Lakers or,
Yeah, that's weird that the popular teams get most of the coverage. I don't really understand that. Maybe you should also try and look for NRL news in your home city about any team that isn't the Brisbane Broncos.
Yeah, that's true. It's a little bit Golden State-ish, though, isn't it? Mark Jackson, Golden State, where they've got all this talent and they show these flashes, but no one really takes them as a serious threat yet.
The Nuggets.
Yeah.
I think if you're not taking the Nuggets as a serious threat now, there's something wrong with you, because they're a very, very, very good basketball team and they're really well coached. Mm. And they've still got parts to come back. I mean, this is not a fluke. They went to the conference semifinals last year. They're in the conference finals this year. They're going to be a problem. They're going to lose to the Lakers, but only because the Lakers have LeBron and AD, and that matters. I mean, it's currently 3-1, and we can make all the 3-1 comeback jokes you like, but the Lakers, like the Heat, only have to win one game in the next three. And if they can't do that, then they don't deserve to be in the finals.
Yeah, I think Spo just works shit out, doesn't he? Like, they got smacked in the face, and then he's like, okay, well.
Well, he didn't even get smacked in the face because every one of these games is close.
Yeah. And that's the thing. Like, Denver have lost two games where, I've only watched the highlights and you know, followed the game log today, but they never really look like they were out of it. Do you know what I mean? Like, that they never felt like they were being streeted and the Lakers could just relax. They were always just in touch.
Yeah. Yeah, that was pretty much what it is. It was generally within 10.
Mm.
And with the Heat, they generally get down 17 and then start playing. So.
Yeah. Which is bizarre for a side that's – well, maybe it's just that they're fitter than everybody else.
I just think they have absolute belief in their ability to close. And for all the, you know, Jimmy hasn't been actually doing that much, if you look at the box score, whenever it comes down to really important shit at the end of games, he is in it up to his fucking ridiculous parallelogram hairdo. He's all over it. Unless Tyler Hero is shooting threes and shit. That was a ridiculous game from that boy. And he might go for three in the next game, and by the time the listeners hear this, the game five will have been played. So you'll know more than we will. But I can see that one getting wrapped up in six.
Well, I'm a lot happier with Lakers Heat than I would be with Lakers Celtics. That just feels a bit too, I don't know, boring.
The thing is because we've had so many Lakers Celtics series in our lifetimes. How many Lakers Celtics series have you watched?
Two. I watched all the KG.
Two.
Oh, that was only two, wasn't it? Because the other one that who did the Lakers beat? Was that Orlando that they beat?
2009 was Orlando.
Orlando, yeah, yeah.
There's only two,
yeah. Because I never watched any of the old ones.
We're not going to pretend that there was live coverage of the Lakers Celtics series of the 80s, because there fucking wasn't.
No, we went back and watched some of that stuff on YouTube, and it's not really watchable.
It's plodding dog shit. You know, it's like staring a turd around.
Yeah.
And the thing is that this Celtics team, you know, it's easy to like your Jalen's and or Jason's and you know, Brent Stevens and all that sort of stuff. But, you know, Marcus Smart's a knob, but of course you expect that. But then they bring back Gordon Hayward and you think, fuck that guy. Just fuck that guy. Yeah, he finally had this kid because, you know, he's been – the last time they had a kid, they had a gender reveal party and discovered he was having a girl, and he looked like someone had told him his dog had died. but this one's a boy, and the boy's just come out. And, you know, you feel awful about thinking poor thoughts about someone when they've just had a baby. But he named the kid after himself. So this is the caliber of fuckwit we're dealing with here.
Mm.
But it was funny that apparently the noise out of Boston from all the fucking, you know, phone up the radio station and complain on talkback kind of word is how upset they are. Not that they're losing to the Heat, but they're losing to the Heat when the Heat are playing zone. There's this obsession, the zone being a defensive scheme that is only played in fucking high school and that it shouldn't work in the NBA. But, you know, as a coach, I suspect whatever scheme you come up with, if you put professional, high-grade, best players in the world and you implement the scheme with it, it's going to be a good enough scheme to work at the NBA level. if you've got the talent to pull it off.
Hmm. Well, yeah, I can't remember who said it this week, but someone was saying if everyone goes to the zone in the NBA, then the zone's useless, and you can guarantee that the Heat won't be running a zone then, because then everyone gets comfortable with it and knows how to break it down quite easily. It's the reason it works so well is that all these guys don't have the reps against it, and hardly anyone runs it in a random game, you know.
But also that it's like one of these things, like there's a huge ego element to not playing it. The same way, you know, American basketball players never challenge somebody who's trying to dunk because they don't want to end up on a poster. There's a whole fucking advantage there if you can set aside your ego and actually do these things. There's a competitive asymmetry there.
Mm. Yeah,
it's like mancatting. Everyone should mancat all the time.
Yeah,
because of the minority of fucking printing dickheads who complain about it.
That's right. Just make it, you know, just make it standard. Yeah, it's funny how offenses have gotten a little bit more similar. You know, most teams run pretty much the same stuff, and it's like the out there defense that's causing the problems this postseason.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, a Heat Lakers series would be fun. You'd have a lot of LeBron versus Miami, and you'd have a lot of Riley versus LA, and you'd have a lot of, you know, you have a lot of kind of flashy big market kind of stuff, and the basketball itself would be fun. That would actually be a pretty good way to end a fucking catastrophic year, and get out of there and get ready to start the new basketball season in, which is the nearest estimate we have as to when the season will be starting.
Yeah. Well, it's. I think it'll be whenever they don't have to do it in a bubble again.
Yeah, whenever they can make money. And they've been talking, they're hoping for like MLK Day, which is sort of mid to late January. But the problem with that is that's the middle of winter and COVID's going to be racking up something fierce. Mm. And also it's going to be post-election and, you know, potentially lame duck president period. Not that keen to hand over control, and oh dear, it's not looking good. A basketball season might be the least of these people's worries.
Yeah, that's right. It might be better for the NBA just to park themselves for a couple of months, and you know, unlike normal where their off season is almost a separate season, just you know, not be part of the media narrative for a while.
Yeah,
don't let everything else play out.
Don't end up in any strife.
Hmm. Yeah. Any other sporting takes, Doc?
You've run out of material, haven't you?
I have. I haven't watched much sport this week. Like bits and pieces here and there, but yeah, not as much as I'm still getting my head around the fact that the Premier League season started.
Well, we should talk about that. I mean, Leeds lost 4-3 to Liverpool, a team much better than them that they had no chance of beating, and then they won 4-3 against Fulham, a team worse than them, who came up with them in the Championship, who they should have beaten comfortably. So it's all very Leeds at Leeds, scoring lots of goals, conceding lots of goals, almost beating teams that they've got no business beating, and almost losing to teams they've got no business losing to. Liverpool still doing Liverpool things. Man City and Man United only just came back in because they got an extra week off because they were playing in European games later into the year than the rest of them, so that they've had an extra week off. But probably Man United could have done with an extra week on top of that because they got beaten by Crystal Palace, ironically the team part owned by the Sixers owners.
Hmm.
I've ran out of content too.
Dear.
I've been watching lots of obviously Le Mans 24 Hour, of course, as we previewed on last week, because while you were up the coast, we had Matt on to preview. Well, that was a loose construct for the pod, to preview the Le Mans 24 Hour, and that's been run and won. The bad Toyota did badly, which is good. And also MotoGP and There's another weekend of MotoGP and Formula One and the Nürburgring 24 Hours and a whole lot of other stuff. So I suspect I'm going to be watching quite a lot of that.
Yeah, I guess motorsport is relatively easy to be COVID safe.
Yeah.
As long as you don't have teams. Well, as long as you don't have fans, I mean.
Well, that, yes and no, because you need a very big bubble. And Porsche had to pull one of their teams out of the Nürburgring 24 Hours because they'd been exposed at Le Mans and a couple of the team members had got returned positive COVID tests. So they had to pull that entire group who were going to go and then run in Nürburgring, which is two different rules. The Nürburgring 24 Hours is like the Bathurst 12-hour. It runs the GT3 spec sports cars, whereas Le Mans runs, you know, the prototypes and the big GT cars and things like that. But some of the Porsche factory drivers and mechanics, you know, work in both series. But they've had to pull them from Nürburgring. So they're still exposed to COVID because it's more like not through contact because of the nature of the work, but just because of workplace stuff. You know, you're in the same space, you're sharing, you know, you're eating in the same place, you're staying in the same hotel and that sort of stuff. It's much more likely that's the kind of transmission you get.
Yep.
But, you know, there's a few cases of it popping up in the Formula One bubble, like the Formula One journalist Will Buxton, who hosts quite a lot of the Formula One TV stuff. He's come down with COVID, so he's had to sit out for the race that's on this weekend. A race or two ago, one of the Moto2 guys in the MotoGP series, the series below MotoGP, who's a championship contender, but he returned a positive COVID test, so he had to sit out a weekend. So I mean, it's still happening, and because it's an individual sport, it fucks up your championship, but you know, it's better than dying. It is a bit disheartening to see the numbers saying to sort of second wave in Europe, because it kind of felt like they'd figured it out, and clearly everyone's got a bit too fucking comfortable, and it's bouncing back.
Yeah, it's hard. Like, even at my work, because there was sort of mini clusters around where we worked, and they, you know, my work's really good at sort of locking down the protocols again, but you know, there was a bit of grumbling and guys got a bit sloppy and stuff like that. So,
well, yeah, and your industry more broadly has challenges with that, because there's a lot of casual work, and there's a lot of people for whom this is the job, and it, you know, you can't just go home and sit it out because you need to feed your fucking family.
You can't bone out a body of beef from fucking home in the home office, that's for sure.
I'm not going to mention what the job is.
Yeah.
Bezo works in porn.
Mm. Oh, dear. And I think we should leave it there.
Well, particularly now that the title for the podcast is Boning Out a Body of Beef.
see if that one gets past Apple. Oh, dear.
No, it'll right, just Doc. Be using a euphemism for trying to get Anthony Davis off the post. see, Mark Jackson saying, he really boned out that body of beef. Mama, there goes that man. And just Van Gundy says, what the fuck are you talking about, you fuck weird? Can you fuck off and just go and become some sort of evangelical preacher in the fucking deep south? Makes your fortune that way, you absolute fucking charlatan. Stop stealing money from Disney.
All right. I'll catch you on the flip side, Doc.
I think that was the sports podcast.
It was. I'll go and get a whiskey.
Boning out a body of beef.